The hour has come and we have Vespers on the other side, so let's get started. My name is Jane Rieke, and this is the first in the series this week on children with disabilities with the subtitle, What's to be Done? This evening we're going to talk about, sort of set the stage with the beginning concepts of some of the developmental stages to which children go, some of the things we've learned by research in the last few years, and some information about early warnings, some kinds of things we can look for, be aware of when children are still young, and sort of set the stage that way for our discussions for the rest of the week. I see that we are sort of a mixed generational group here. Wondering how many of you have some idea about how long it's been since our society here in the United States has been concerned about, has been recognizing, has been helping, has been doing much at all for children who have disabilities, or the term I prefer, children with special needs? How long has it been since society has recognized the needs of these kinds of children in our society?
I think just recently.
Yes, you're right. How recently is just recently?
Well, 25 years.
No,
25 years sort of max. 25 years max. In order to set this sort of in perspective, I'd like to give you just a mini history lesson by way of a true story. It's a story that happened here in Washington. It begins really in the mid-1940s with a man and his wife who lived in Seattle, and I'll call them Jones because that's not their names, who had a severely multiply handicapped daughter born about that time. She had cerebral palsy, she had a vision problem, she was retarded, and she had a learning disability. That's about as multi as you can be. And because they were a family with funds, they took their daughter all over the country to try to get things fixed. So they went to Rochester, they went to Philadelphia, you know, one place for eyes, one place for the body, and one place to see what they could do about getting her tested, some special teaching schools. And finally what they did in the early 1950s was to hire a governess, a live-in governess, to teach her how to read and to write, and also to give her some training with social skills so that she could fit in as well as possible into her family's rather extensive social life. And then in the late 1950s, the governess came to Mr. Jones and said, I have done everything I can, and you have a very lonesome teenage daughter. And of course, that's the way it was, because there wasn't any place for children with disabilities to meet other children. And so he came to the University of Washington with a proposition. He would fund a program at the university for 5 startup years if there were some disciplines in that university who would band together in a cooperative way so that parents who had children with special needs could come to one place instead of shop the way he had to do to get help for themselves as a family and for their children. University of Washington is a pretty good sizable university, but there was quite a search to find, first of all, people who were interested in children with special needs, and secondly, people who were willing to work together. That's not the way university disciplines were doing in those days. And they found 5. This is the late 1950s. Some one man from the medical school was willing to give it a try. Many of the problems we identify early as medical problems. There was a nice medical school, The medical clinic for children who were retarded was, you probably guess, in the basement of an old building off campus. That's where the clinic was. Psychology was interested in testing, trying out some of their testing tools for children with different kinds of problems. Speech and hearing was interested. They were already seeing children, especially young children, who had been identified as having hearing problems. They were identifiable, they were seeing those. They were also seeing children who were not talking and weren't hard of hearing. They didn't know what was going on. They were interested, and that clinic had a social worker, so there's number four, social work. And can you guess what the fifth one might have been? Public health nursing. As the nurses were going about their public health duties in the community, they were finding families with children who had disabilities who were not out of the house. And so those five disciplines said, yes, we'll pick up the challenge and see what we can do to mount some kind of a program. And then he dropped the other shoe. And I want a school for my daughter. So, quickly to the College of Education. There was nothing like special education in 1960. Nothing. Look where we are now. There was, however, one teacher and associate professor who taught one class in the varieties of other kinds of problems children have. A survey course. And she picked up the challenge, and so there were six. And then something happened in the history of our country which gave the whole field of children with special needs a boost. You recall what that was? That's right. The President of the United States had a sister who was retarded, and he said so. And with that, families brought the children out of the attics and out of the basement and out of the closets, and families exposed their own pain about children with special needs. And with that emphasis from the federal government, there were a number of federal grants made available to programs, especially university programs, who would mount a research program and what's called an interdisciplinary training, a place where people from different disciplines could get together and find out what to do and share their ignorance, which is what it was at that time. And these grants were available to states, universities, in states which would provide matching funds. We're talking about 1960. University of Washington, already having had a start from Mr. Jones, had some people interested. We had a director who was out to get money because we had 5 years and the money was going to dry up where we were. And what became the Child Development and Mental Retardation Center at the University of Washington was the first three such centers funded in the country. There have since been others, and there are similar interdisciplinary research centers, mostly in university settings, but not exclusively, across the country. So that's the beginning, and that's 1960. And they had a mission statement. Does that sound familiar to you? Churches have a mission statement. We all are invited to prepare mission statements. And the mission statement was a threefold mission statement dedicated to research into child development and handicapping conditions, interdisciplinary training, and service to families, to children and their families. And these centers across the country have been dedicated to those kinds of goals since that time, and that's not been very long ago. And a few years ago, as you were saying, not too long ago, House Bill 94142 was passed in our Congress, which mandated public education for children with disabilities. Handicapped children, a number of terms are used. And so we now have children appearing in our schools, riding on buses, in our neighborhoods, and we really don't know very much about them, nor what to do about them, but they are with us. And a lot has been done, a lot can be done. The past 25 years has been a massive expansion in information, in training, in opportunities, and it's still going on. But that's a very short term of time, very short period of time for all of those things to have happened and for us to be where we are now. And there are many communities which do not have many handicapped people in their community, or where the handicapped children are not comfortable in our churches, are not comfortable in our stores, and where we have a lot to learn in order to understand them and to make them comfortable. I think just the fact that people with handicaps are more visible in our society has increased our comfort level some. But what we have not recognized is that the best time to start, if we want to do good intervention, is as early as possible, and by that I mean 1 year, 2 year, kind of 3 years at the latest. And those are some of the kinds of things that we want to talk about tonight. It's been my privilege to be with this Child Development Mental Retardation Center for the full 25 years of their life. And so I bring that to this place as a resource, and I've already talked to some of you here, and I know that we have resources in our midst here. And over the week that we are together, perhaps we can share our information, share what we know about our own children or children in our neighborhood, and together perhaps do a better job for the children who are our children or children in our midst somehow. Well, this evening what I want to do is to start with what we know about child development, what we've learned in the past 20, 25 years, so that we can identify some of the early warning signs that we should be aware of in the very early years. A number of years ago, let's say 20 years, just to give us a round number, medical people had scales that said all children at 1 year should be doing this, you know, walk, say mama, dada, papa, that. All children at 2 years should be doing these things. All children at 3 years should be doing these. And we had those general guidelines, sort of 20 years ago. But when you begin to work with children with disabilities, there was nothing that said how you get from here to here. And all of the children that I worked with were between there. So we didn't have any guidelines about sequences or progressions that gave us help in teaching. And as we become more and more isolated families, we don't have grandparents and aunts around to give us that kind of wisdom about what one expects at certain stages in child development. One of the things we've learned in the research that's come about from child development is that normal child development is very predictable and very sequential. Children don't read Spock. They don't know that they're supposed to walk by 1 year. Some walk at 10 months, some at 12, some at 14, some at 16. But they don't walk until they sit. And they don't run until they walk. And there are certain progressions which we know about, perhaps more in things that are physical that we see, like walking and drawing, than in some of the less visible and obvious child development areas. So, sequentially, we know, for example, that children who in the gross motor sequence area will sit by the time they're about 12 and stand by the time they're a year and walk by the time they're a year and a half and run by the time they're 2 and 2 and a half. And that sequence is built on a progression of motor development which the physical therapists know all about, and which that discipline brings to us. And a physical therapist can look at a child and say, trunk muscles, this is what we know. I don't see that. How many? But I now know, because of my work with physical therapists, I can tell a kid that I see is klutzy. And if I see a klutzy kid with this kind of a language problem, I know we've got a learning disability coming up. See, those kinds of things that we know for patterns. So first of all, I want to talk about some normal sequences, and then we want to talk about some early patterns, early warnings. Let me give you another sequence. Because by and large, one of the most telling areas for an intact system is the area of language development. And one of the areas where you get your early warnings about potential problems is in the language area. And if we don't know it well, we can do some pretty awful things to kids. So just for the sake of a sequence and for the idea of a prerequisite, let me give you something in the oral language sequence. So for example, we would expect, well, the sequence goes this way. First of the sequence is what we call vowel sounds. You call that cooing in a child, and happy sounds. Not the crying, but the ah-wee, the happy sounds. The coming on of vowel sounds. You listen to them, you'll hear vowels in them. It is from the vowels that words are made. People who start children out with consonant sounds don't know what problems they're causing. You start with the vowels. So you've got to know these sequences. The next thing in the sequence is what I call intonation patterns. The melody patterns. The ooh, ee, the happy up and down thing. Very critical. You know what? Pay attention to those. You hear people say, oh, you're talking to me. That's just wonderful. That's the way it ought to be. That encourages that, more of that, and the playing with those sounds. Then we get a little bit later, consonants. Then they begin to put stops, beginnings. You get the ba, 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 ma, ma, da, da sorts of things. The next in the development, children begin to use these to make words. They put the vowel and the inflected vowel and the consonant together, and we get the naming of things. Ba for ball or bottle. Ba ba or bye bye. Bye bye. That's beautiful. I would prefer bye bye to bye bye. Got to get that in it, and I'll tell you why pretty soon. Naming, and then, so you have, let's say, naming. And then you have to have some other words before you can possibly have words together. You can't put words together with all nouns. So what do you have to have? Some verbs, some power words like up, 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 down, some go. So you need some... And I keep wondering, are the children hearing these words too? Are we so focused on the naming that we forget that that's an important part of the whole process? Pretty soon you get enough of these, you get sentences. And that's a sequence. But there is a hidden prerequisite for sentences, to which some children do not go very well. And it's an early warning for me that if we don't have this one, we don't get that one. Because sentences are built on the inflection patterns. And when we know that sequence, and we have a child who is not doing well, or not going through it, or is stuck someplace, and we know where to go, then we can begin intervening and helping. And these are some of the things that we have learned in the years of research, for which we are very grateful, because it helps us help young children get unstuck if they're stuck in a place, or begin to identify children who may need to see for short terms or longer terms certain kinds of people who can especially help them. So there are in each and a number of developmental areas sequences, and I brought a preschool profile. It's called the preschool profile, and I don't expect us to look to see that, but I want us to be aware of all of the developmental areas that are going on at one time in a child's life. Just in order to get sort of squared away, there are 8 developmental areas across the top, and down the side, these are divided, these squares are years. Now, I don't want to get hung up on the years. It's not as important as the sequence. All right, just the fact that it represents it. So children go through a certain orderly sequence in the gross motor department. Hidden, and the way we use it is we have a child come in and we give it to a parent and say, just put a line through the things that your child does well. And so here we come down, let's say we have, I'm going to use a 4-year-old tonight for example. Let's say we come down with a 4-year-old child, does well with sitting without support, pulls himself to a standing position, rolls the ball well, walks alone, walks backward well, can't walk backward yet, picks up things without falling, walks up and down the stairs without help, well, not very well, but can do some of these things, so we're not going to worry. Runs forward well, jumps, can't jump very well, can't jump, can't walk unaided, can't balance, and all of a sudden, pulled out of those are a number of things which require balance. And so a child may do almost everything except a few items, and you're never going to be concerned about a few items, but they cluster. You understand what I mean? They cluster. So what does that mean? Well, it may mean a number of things. It may mean only that the child hasn't been exposed. There are no stairs in your house. Or these with the babysitter always takes his hand. Or a number of things that have to do with exposure, experience. I'd rather be concerned and ask than not ask. It may be that there's enough here going that you need a little physical therapy. Rather get it and get the child on board than not. It may be an indication of something else. But at least those things will pull out. That's just an example. Fine motor. This fine motor starts with from grasping. You hear about the pincer grasp, the doctor says, can he pick up small things, put them in a bottle? That's related, clear down here, to writing. The prerequisite for writing is right up here in the first year. There it goes. These things we know. Pre-academic skills, first year of life, this says, tracks objects smoothly. You know what that's related to? Reading. To reading. Right up here. Does the child use his eyes smoothly? And do you see the nurses or the doctors think they'll see if the child follows? They're looking more than following. They're looking at whether he falls like this or whether the eyes go like this. These are some of the things we look for that give us some clue to ease of reading down here. So there's some of those things. Following directions. Self-help skills. All the kinds of things. And down here about 2, if things like the child should be doing, like getting his own drink of water, opening the door by the step, and you wonder about the terrible 2s. You know, they should be doing those things by themselves and wanting to do those things by themselves and not being waited on. And it's sometimes helpful to say, oh, that's all right then. That's where it belongs. Music, art, and story time has a sequence that's very useful to teachers, preschool teachers. Social skills and play skills. So here we have plays near children at 1 year, about 2.5 to 3, plays next to or near, begins to interact, and interacts well. So you don't expect a 2-year-old to share everything and interact like a 5-year-old sister does. Not supposed to. If he does, it's kind of not normal. So you've got to, that's probably an overstatement, but you have to realize that there's a progression there too. And we don't often realize. Understanding of language, up here, very early on, it says respond differentially to the telephone, vacuum, refrigerator. By differentially means recognizes the differences. If a child doesn't, I'm going to know them. What would you suspect? Hearing. Wow, yes. Responds to come, give, go. The child doesn't respond. Ask about it. Not always a behavior problem. Sometimes, but quite frequently, hearing. And down in here we have things like responds to the sentence, show me what mother cooks on. And parents will say, oh, he knows what a stove is. You say, what's that? They stove. But show me what mother cooks on is a long question, even though the answer is simple. What's the processing system like? Do you find yourself changing the way you talk to the child to get the child to respond? We do it almost subconsciously. And you do that changing to help the child learn, but you should know that you changed. And that, therefore, there should be a concern. Well, this is just an idea about some things that we know about child development and some things that we need to be, that we could be aware of that might be helpful to us in looking at some of the problems that some of the children have. All right, to get a feeling for what we're talking about and the importance of it. Now I want to talk about what we know about profiles and what some of those things can mean. There are some kinds of problems, issues that families experience more or less traumatically that are present at birth. Mostly they're physical. Some not so traumatic, although it's traumatic to have a child born with a cleft lip or cleft palate. Visually, it's traumatic. But it can be fixed surgically, early, and there are no lasting effects, and the cosmetic surgery is pretty good. Then there are traumatic things like Down syndrome, when you're in for perhaps health problems, some level of retardation, and special education for a long time. That's traumatic. Spina bifida is traumatic. It's a long time grief process. A long time that you're going to be in the special health world. Fetal alcohol syndrome, discovered at the University of Washington within these 20 years, and now we hope that we know what causes this type of retardation. No more drinking, moms. You kids get retarded because of alcohol in the system. It's called fetal alcohol syndrome. Something we found out. Traumatic things that you discover at birth. There are some kinds of disabilities, problems that we discover in the first year. One of those is autism. About 40 weeks, we begin to notice children don't want to interact. Very traumatic for parents to have a child turn away at that, a babe at that age. Cerebral palsy, sometimes not very visible, not very observable, so the child begins to use hands in a purposeful way, or try to crawl in a purposeful way, and when they are purposeful, and the muscles don't work well, then we begin to realize that there's something there, that a lifelong problem, treatable but not curable is what I'm talking about. And then there's some kinds of problems that we don't really, aren't really sure about or really think about seriously until the child is 3 or 4. When things aren't moving quite like they should. Things like learning disabilities, things like auditory processing problems, which is in the learning disability area, things like the apraxias, children who don't talk, slow learners, and frequently the things like learning disabilities and apraxias, the children are intellectually very well endowed. So you haven't suspected retardation because they catch on quickly, but they don't talk well, or they can't learn this well, or they don't pay attention well, and we're into some educational kinds of special needs, special problems. And so not everything is observable at birth, and some things we discover within the first, hopefully within the first 5 years of life. And because this is such a new field, sometimes we're finding out now when a child is 8 or 10 or 12, something that had the child been born 10 years later, we would have found sooner. So we will, over the course of the time, be talking about those too. But let's look at profiles just a bit. This is 4 years, right there. And no child, you know, child is 4 is going to be moving along in there pretty much. A child who looks like 4 and is maybe, like that is a fairly typical, I would call a flat pattern, functioning about what age level? 2. A rather typical pattern of retardation. And that's not as difficult to work with, except for our cognition about seeing a child that's this size, who is really learning at this size. And if we can get over this, you know, blinder out the size factor and think in terms of what the child can do and treat the child as if the child were 2, the child will learn more slowly, will be comfortable, will be happy, will do well. But if you expect 4-year-old behavior from this 2-year-old ability, you'll have behavior problems and you'll have all sorts of things on your hands. Because you can't. The expectation is always for what you can't do. So you get your what we do with a profile like this is to find out what the child can do and start there. You don't look at the can't-dos. You look at the can-dos, and if you have children in your preschool programs who come in like this, I don't care if they're 4 years old, if they are comfortable with this age child, that's where they should be. Because that's where they will do their learning and growing. Not being constantly buffeted by inability. Okay? So much for that. We have some kinds of patterns where children are maybe clear down here. Let's say like this. And sometimes like this, and sometimes like this. Academically, just fine, except don't look directly at adults. They can read, they can figure, they love books, they don't like you at all. Social skills, that's up about a year, if that. Autistic kinds of kids. They'll not play with other people, they won't look at you, they don't always respond to you. Sometimes their language, what they give of it, is good sentences, but not very related. Academically do just fine. A very difficult kind of thing for parents and families to understand and deal with. because that's not the normal progression that we expect, and you deal with each developmental level differently. That takes a lot of support, a lot of help. Because where are you going to put that child in your class? Very difficult. You have to pick up this relational thing someplace. I don't work on academics. I work on relational things. And sometimes when you work on relational things, the academics back up and lose. It's all right. Give us something even to work with for the child to fit into society. They'll pick up. That's very difficult. Let me give you one more pattern, just to be kind of looking at what we can find out from early childhood development. Let's say we have a 4-year-old child is about here with his balance is out, can't do that balance thing, and can't do that balance thing. Doing just fine here, doing just fine here, okay, maybe not so well on social, doesn't ride trikes like the other kids do, some of those kinds of things. And maybe even like that, where you have anywhere from a year to 2-year delay in the language areas and a year to 6 months delay in the motor area, academically fine. But the way that child learns language is an indicator of the way that child is going to learn other things. And you're going to have a child, kind of child we call learning disabled in our society. And it's not 100%, but about 80% of the time we'll have the language area lagging behind and a little bit on the motor and other things looking pretty good at the age of 4 until you get into things like reading and into the sorts of things where you need good sentences, good sentence structure, and the child doesn't have the ability to put some of those things together. So we get patterns. And what I wanted to mention by early warnings was there are, in each of these areas, you may have one area that has some lags in the developmental area. You may have some patterns that people in clinics can help you with. But we know enough about child development now and enough about sequences that we can give a lot of help about what's going on and when you should be concerned. And let me say only that if you have a question, ask. Do not go for the he'll outgrow it or she'll outgrow it. There are enough good places around, and this kind of information is available enough that people should be able to give you some help. Okay. Sequences within a variety. Look what's going on in a child's life. Busy kids, aren't they? Developing and growing in all of those areas at one time. I think they do it in spite of us mostly, rather than because of us. But it's the children who have special needs that have helped us learn how to be facilitators and helpful to normal children as well as to children who have special needs. Well, maybe that's enough to get us started. Perhaps you have some kind of questions you'd like to ask, or what more do you want to know? Anybody? Yes?
This bill that you mentioned, okay, does that cover help for the child only like when the child is in elementary, or how long does this go on? What kinds of things are...
Hospital 9412 started out a mini lesson. Hospital 94142, it's a federal bill, and it is available in all states from first grade through the age of 21, child 21. Some states now have public education available for children who are 3. Some states have public funds available for children from birth. So for example, in some programs, if a child is born with Down syndrome, he probably enrolls in the program when he's 1 month old. And in some states, this is paid for by the state. It is a funds from the federal government to provide special education programs, supportive therapy, physical therapists, occupational therapists, nursing help, speech pathologists, audiologists in the public schools, and teachers with special training, also assistance to those teachers. Busing, all of those things come under that bill. And if you have a child, on Wednesday I'm going to talk about that process. So the people who are interested in the process and what you're getting into and how, and what your role is in it, or if you want to see me separately, we can talk about that. But there is a process that schools have available for parents of children and that education is available. You had a question?
I was going to ask about dyslexia.
Yes.
If that would be detected early, or can it be reversed if it is detected earlier? You want to get into that at another session?
I'll say just a few words about it, and then dyslexia is just another word for learning disabilities. There are a number of kinds of programs in schools for children with dyslexia. It's not reversible. It is, shall I say, treatable, can be improved, but it's a problem that sticks around. I mean, it's not curable, that's it. The general rule of thumb about learning disability and dyslexia is that if the child has not learned to read well, write well, those kind of things, by the time the child is 10 to 12, then you go for alternate systems. Teach them to use a calculator, teach them to use a typewriter, you know, some of those kinds of things. Because they need some coping skills rather than to keep fighting something that's not going to kill. Maybe that's about as much as I'm prepared to say about it. Does that answer your question, though?
Yes.
Yeah. Somebody else? Yes?
A little more about the fetal alcohol syndrome.
Fetal alcohol syndrome? Surely. Fetal alcohol syndrome is a syndrome with which a child is born. The characteristics are flattened cheekbones. There is a difference to the eye around here. So the bones and the muscular of the face give us a characteristic look. And children with fetal alcohol syndrome are retarded. It comes about from parents, I think mostly mothers at this stage, who have been drinking during their pregnancy. And the drinking affects the fetus in this way. And the children in all countries look the same. Once you know it's that same sort of facial structure that you see and this kind
so
of retardation.
So there are different levels in terms of severity of retardation?
Yes. The children that we have had, and we've had some in our school, are not severely retarded. They can be educated, but they are going, many of them will need group homes, that sort of level of help for themselves. That help?
Yeah, I'm just a little curious. I teach third grade, mm-hmm. and I had a child last year in my class that had fetal alcohol syndrome, and it seems inappropriate for her to be in my, I teach a regular third grade classroom. Mm-hmm. And
It's where the problem lies, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes they have what we call the cocktail chatter. They talk and talk and talk and talk and they don't say anything. maybe we ought to talk sometime about what you can do or not do or what the school district.
Yeah.
Because the The latest things that they're trying to do with reference to education for special children is what they call mainstreaming, and it's not being well done. Yeah, somebody's saying, for some children, some contact in regular classrooms is a good thing, but they have to be careful about what kind of contact, if the child is comfortable, if the teacher's comfortable, if the child can get the kind of help the child needs to be maintained in that classroom, and the number of skills it takes. For example, we think that when a child has a certain level, let me say, of academic acceptance, that the child can be well mainstreamed into, let's say, a high school class. But do you know how many skills are involved in following a high school class too? How many language skills? How many understanding skills? How many find your way around the building skills? How many learn your way in the cafeteria skills? How many of all of those things are needed in addition to reading and writing? And some of those kinds of things, like what you're finding in your classroom, the behavioral kinds of things for which this child is not prepared to fit into a classroom as well. And so those are also factors that need to be considered as we look at children with special needs. And of how many other, we think in school in terms of the reading, the academic things, but there are a number of other things that need to be done to help the children be a part of our society and be good for you. And that's what this is about, is to give some ideas. A couple of years ago, I talked to the State Association for Children with Learning Disabilities parents, and about a couple hundred people there, and I asked how many people there, and they were people, children in school, not the school-age children, had some idea that something wasn't quite right by the time the child was two or three, about 95% said, in the language areas where it was. Either understanding or using language. They were concerned about language. And they were told, don't worry, the child will outgrow it. Let's wait till the child gets in school, and a number of those things. And so that's what this is all about, to say, let's get in there and have a look at some of these things. Fortunately, we do have public we have special education programs, resource people. And in part because, you see, she's not understanding the way we expect her to understand that auditory processing problem there. But give her another way of learning visually or something else. So these are some of the... See, this is the hard one to understand, it seems to me, that has this specific... That keeps... Right kid who copes, you know, she's coped through a lot of stress, but still... There's going to be help though for this one. And she's not yet 12. So we're going to just fine. Any other questions you have to ask? About kids in your neighborhood or about anything we've said up here? I don't want to scare you. I hope this is helpful. Just to
say. Do you understand that you said 95% of the people felt their child did have a learning problem?
Parents had concerns about their child when they were two. Some specific areas of concern, the child didn't imitate. You know, most children learn by imitation. You throw the ball and they throw it back. Or you do the patty cake thing or some of those things and they pick it up. Or you do the blah, 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 blah. Maybe these children didn't do that. They didn't learn by imitation. So that was one of the, when I did a little research project because I was interested in what they were finding out then that we didn't know here. And the lack of imitation was one of them. The lack of intonation pattern was another of them. The fact that they were so klutzy. Not that they couldn't do things, but they fell over their own feet. And see, those are three very different things, aren't they? And you think, well, it's a little bit klutzy. Well, he'll learn, he doesn't. But when you put them all together, those three things, they added up to a combination of neurological problems. That's why I say not reversible, because it's pretty much neurological. and you have to see what you can do to counter it. But imitation is a neurological kind of thing, the balance thing is a neurological kind of thing, and the natural acquisition of oral language is a neurologically based thing. So you put those things together and you have
it. But was your statement that of children who later were known to
that's
have
right.
a problem, 95%
of the parents
suspected by each student.
That's right.
It wasn't 95% of all parents.
No. Of the children who had been identified and who were in this in special programs, 95% of the parents there said they had suspected a problem. But they hadn't, they were so light, so slight. They hadn't really, it nag and nod, but how do you put your finger on it when your child is learning? It's keeping up with other kids in most things, and hanging on. And so that's, I'm saying, there are those, that was just the experience with that group. Somebody over here? Yes.
In the handling of the alcoholism, are you working on preventing this,
yes.
know, prenatal classes, and are doctors cooperating? Like, if they don't have
absolutely, 100%. That now that they know what it is, we hope that there will be no more, because prevention is the only cure. Prevention. And so the doctors, at least in the state of Washington, that's one of the first things, and young friends of mine say, I want to get pregnant so I stop drinking. that's the way it goes. And so that's the only prevention.
But did smoking have an effect on
The research is being done now. I don't know what the final.
I think the birth weight is
down. The birth weight's down.
Smaller, yeah.
Smaller babies. More at-risk babies. Mm-hmm. But that's about as much as
I was listening to Dr. Dobb in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You might know him. He's made a lot of Christian radio. He said any kinds of drugs during pregnancy is really dangerous. Mm-hmm. Any kinds of things, if not any kind, even aspirin, too many aspirin, too many painkillers. He was saying, mother, stay away from them. You don't know why your kids are coming up retarded, but they're finding out some of these kids are having learning problems because the parents took a little too many same aspirin, painkillers.
Matter of fact, in this interdisciplinary diagnostic group that I've been working with for a number of years, one of the fascinating people in that group for me has been the dentist, who can look at a child who comes to the clinic and say, I don't know which one it was, but in the first three months of her pregnancy, or at 3 months, she was taking some kind of medication or drug that stained the child's teeth this way. Wow. Then you go back and say, what was being given to mothers at that time? That kind of research is very helpful. And they find almost nothing is good. Because somehow it gets into the bloodstream and affects the fetus. Time for us to get some closure. We've got about 5 minutes. In order to help us pull this together, I'd like to have us, somebody tell me, what's been useful? What have you learned? What do you want to take with you from here? Anybody? One idea. All right. Don't let it go. Ask, inquire. Good. If nothing else, that's wonderful. I'm satisfied. Anything else?
I think your chart for parents would be excellent.
All right.
Get it into the hands of parents.
Just the concept of developmental sequences, just that idea, and the fact that down what's clear up here in year one is going to affect what's clear down here. To say developmental sequences, that idea.
And encouragement of knowing there is help.
All right. There is help. Pretty lonesome sometimes, isn't it, when you sit at home and worry about it, or you ask your neighbor, and there is help. 25 years isn't a lot of time, but we've done a lot of learning. Talked to somebody just yesterday, I think, who said something. They have a child who's 20 now, and that's, you know, we weren't doing very much 5 years ago. The child's been with a neurologist in a smallish town who's given a lot of medication. And the question was, the mother was saying, well, I wish she didn't have so much medication. I think she could learn better, but it's procedure control and I don't know. He said, tell the doctor, find out in the literature what's being done. And she can ask that much. And say, I want to know from the literature what the information is on drugs for this. It's her child, it's her business, she should ask that kind of a question. Not that you don't trust, but you can encourage your doctors to get into the literature, it's there.
Lots of times, though, when you ask, though, the doctor will kind of slap you off like it's, you know, you don't need to know.
What would you do then?
You change doctors.
Find out. Find out. Don't get taken that way.
Yeah,
sure. Anything else? That's great. Don't let it go. Ask. Think about developmental sequences. The concept that there is help.